Luke chapter 23. And the whole multitude of them arose, and led him to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, We found this fellow perverting the nation, and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king. And Pilate asked him, saying, Art thou the king of the Jews? And he answered him and said, Thou sayest it. Then said Pilate to the chief priests and to the people, I find no fault in this man. And they were the more fierce, saying, He stirreth up the people, teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place. When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked whether the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged unto Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem at that time. The whole multitude of them. The word multitude here denotes an assembly, not a crowd, not a rabble. It's the assembly of the chief priests and the elders. You know, that group as a whole is coming, and they've come before Pilate to accuse him. He's perverting the nation. He's forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, telling him, don't pay your taxes. And we know that isn't true, because Jesus' response was to give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. So this is a false accusation. And Pilate asked him straight out, Are you king of the Jews? Jesus said, Yeah, I'm the king of the Jews. You said it. Remember, that's a Hebraism denoting strong affirmation. Just like when we say, Are you really going to come with us? You said it. That's absolutely right. It's not saying, You say it. What do you mean I say it? I don't say you're king of the Jews. I want to know if you think you're king of the Jews. Pilate clearly understood him. But in this, he's finding no fault in this man. He probably has heard of Jesus to some degree. Maybe not much, but I mean, remember, not every detail. He might have taken consultation, talked to some of his soldiers. Yeah, we've heard of this guy. He's no particular threat. And as far as stirring up the people, I mean, people get excited when he's around, but he's definitely not a rabble-rouser. As far as this other thing about taxes, we don't know. And besides, you know, resentment against the taxes, or as long as the taxes are being paid, they have no evidence that they weren't paid. Maybe they even had a record of him paying. Actually, we have the tax roll here. He paid his taxes. And there's a lot of ways you could look at it, but Pilate found no reason for fault. Even though he admitted to being king of the Jews, the Christ, to him, he kind of, as the governor of Judea, he would have some understanding of their customs. And like understand, oh, okay, he's the Messiah. But he also probably would have had some insight through ministers or other people involved. I mean, they watch their province. The things going on with Jesus wouldn't have totally escaped their notice. And he certainly finds no reason to put him to death. And at this point, not even to punish him. But they really get excited. All these, you know, the chief priests and the elders. How many men is that going to be? 70, 80, 90? Plus their servants, attendants, friends, you know, everyone they brought together who would be against Jesus. Well, the common people had gladly heard Jesus, but this is all being done under cover of darkness and in the early morning hours. And so you had to be sort of privy to it, to be there. You know, to be in the crowd that's standing before Pilate, you would have had to had foreknowledge that there was going to be an event. Because the people weren't in the habit of just hanging around Pilate's residence or his seat of judgment or whatever. People weren't just always hanging out there in the, you know, 4 a.m. or whenever exactly this is. But they came to him in the night, and they come as a multitude, as a assembly all together, to accuse him to the Roman governor. He finds no fault. But they get more fierce, and they start saying he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place. They're like, you don't understand. He's a very compelling figure. Pilate becomes very interested when he hears Galilee. Is this man a Galilean? Well, send him off to Herod. Who knows precisely what he's thinking? I mean, I've thought at times that he wanted to be rid of the troublesome issue of Christ with the Jews and the chief priests. Maybe he wanted to just put him on Herod. Or maybe he thought he would have some fun. Maybe he thought this was a lot of fun, seeing how agitated these the leaders of the Jews were. You know, just how agitated and upset they were about this guy. And he may have taken no small pleasure in seeing these religious leaders really worked up about something he thought should be right up their alley. You know, here's the religious people upset about a religious leader who's a little too radical for them, or who maybe has said some things that were critical of them. Who knows exactly? But he sends them to Herod. Verse 8, "And when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad, for he was desirous to see him of a long season, because he had heard many things of him, and he hoped to have seen some miracle done by him. Then he questioned him in many words, and he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. And Herod, with his men of war, set him at naught, and mocked him, and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him again to Pilate. And the same day Pilate and Herod were made friends together, for before they were at enmity between themselves." They weren't friends prior to that day. So there's definitely a bit of, you know, this moment has its difficulty, but it sort of helps Herod and Pilate bond as a sort of this troublesome character. But at the same time, I'm sure, as he's questioning him, right? Herod's questioning Jesus, and that's probably irritating. When you ask someone a bunch of questions and they don't answer you, it can be very frustrating. But at the same time, the chief priests and scribes are standing there accusing him of horrible things and just really laying into him. And to see them so upset was probably amusing. And Herod and his men, this guy is nothing. Come on. And they had good sport with him. They mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe. Oh, look at the king of the Jews. I mean, it's funny, the chief priests and scribes were accusing him of being king of the Jews. From Herod's perspective, this is capital. This has to be, to some degree, a lot of irony here. Because Herod is really, Herod's dynasty was not considered legitimate by many Jews because he wasn't of the line of David. And so this king of David comes, and now the men who never held him as legitimate are rejecting the king of the one they say is the son of David. This man says he's the son of David. He's like, well, I never say it. I'm the son of David, and you despise me. And so the dynamic there has to be somewhat amusing for him. And to some degree, the reluctance to actually do anything to Jesus shows the amusement of it all. Oh, you want him killed, do you? Oh, he's no big deal. Put him in a robe. You know, here you go. Here's your king. They think it's funny. And whatever dynamic was going on between Pilate and Herod, this made them friends. You know, Herod would have appreciated him sending someone over to him like that. He always wanted to see this Jesus character, and Pilate sent him to him. And when he came, though a bit disappointing, it was still a lot of fun. And Herod's mind towards Pilate probably would have looked at him as, you know, and there's a lot of subtlety there, you know, respecting his authority over Galilee, and all those things would have gone some way to creating a feeling of mutual understanding. Verse 13, "And Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and the rulers of the people, said unto them, Ye have brought this man unto me, as one that perverteth the people. And behold, I, having examined him before you, have found no fault in this man, touching those things whereof ye accuse him. No, nor yet Herod, for I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done in him. I will therefore chastise him and release him. For of necessity he must release one unto them at the feast." At least that was the custom. And obviously when you break with custom, that could be a big problem. You know, the releasing of one prisoner at the feast was something they looked for. Every concession the Romans gave them, they would want to hold on to. You know, that whole authority of the Romans also would have added to his amusement. Now they're the king of the Jews, the Messiah that they've been longing for. They claim one comes, claiming to be him, and they don't receive him. To him, that's got to be humorous. And now they come to him, the authority they despise, to dispose of the one who is supposed to be their great leader. And of course, he doesn't believe any of this. Every governor has people around him who know things. Soldiers, provincial governors, lesser administrators, who'd be able to tell him something. Even his wife.
who we know from other Gospels, told him to have nothing to do with him, with Christ, that is. His intention is to chastise him and release him. I'm going to punish him with some sort of corporal punishment and let him go. But they all at once cry, away with this man and release him to us, Barabbas. The fact that they cried it all at once means they prepared. They knew. And that's why I say, you know, the crowd that was there was a select group because they knew what was happening. I mean, how often do you hang around the courthouse waiting for a judgment? But when it's a particular person at a particular time, all of a sudden the courtroom is packed because they announce it. Well, this was not announced. This was done in the dead of night. So it was kind of accusers only in this group. And their voices are going to prevail. Maybe a few other people have trickled in. People who might be interested in Christ's redemption. You know, there was, in the Sanhedrin, there was Nicodemus, and there was also Joseph of Arimathea. And they would not be consenting, but their voices aren't going to prevail among such a multitude. And there's a significant number of people here who are set to put Jesus to death. And they're all in agreement together. And that's why it just overwhelms Pilate, because the group that is there is so slanted in one direction. But that, you know, that's the politics. That's a lot of politics. You know, when you get your group together, a few people in one place at one time can make such a big difference. You know, when they have these big protest marches, there's a lot of people there, but really it's a very small percentage of the population. You know, you get 100,000 people in one place and people are like, wow. But it's really, in a nation of 600 million plus, it's a drop in the bucket. It's less than a tenth of a percent. So they asked for Barabbas. Verse 19, for certain sedition made in the city and for murder was cast into prison. He was a murderer and had engaged in sedition, insurrection, had tried to lead a revolt. It's funny, they want someone released whose crime is the thing they accuse Jesus of. They're accusing him of stirring up the people. Now, the kind of stirring up Jesus is doing is, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, for you tithe of mint and anise and cumin, but have neglected the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. He's stirring up the people against the religious leaders, and against them spiritually, and they're afraid of their position. Saying, oh, we're afraid the Romans are going to come. No. They're afraid that he's actually going to win the hearts and minds of the people. Barabbas actually does what they accuse Jesus of. He's actually stirring up the people in a way the Romans are interested in. The Romans aren't interested in the petty conflicts between Jew and Jew over their religious matters. Except that they're making a stir about it, and they've obviously planned this out. They've stacked the deck so that when they come before Pilate, they have an overwhelming majority. They catch him at a time early in the morning, you know, when all this is very... You know, you catch someone, you get them out of bed early in the morning and you start throwing things at them. Especially if they're not a morning person. People can make mistakes. Not that Pilate's making a mistake. Or that he would see it that way. If God hadn't hidden the wisdom from him, he never would have crucified Christ. Verse 20, Pilate, therefore, willing to release Jesus, spake again to them. But they cried, saying, crucify him! Crucify him! And he said unto them the third time, why? What evil hath he done? I have found no cause of death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. And they were instant with loud voices. Then was they were immediately ready and urgent to speak, requiring that he be crucified. And the voices of them and of the chief priests prevailed. There may have been a few voices, but the prevailing opinion in that group was crucify him. And Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they required. And he released unto them him that for sedition and murder was cast into prison, whom they had desired. But he delivered Jesus to their will. And as they led him away, they laid hold upon one Simon, a Cyrenian, coming out of the country, and on him they laid the cross, that he might bear it after Jesus. Jesus is given up to be crucified, given over to their will. And the question throughout history is, you know, who crucified Christ? The Jews crucified Christ. The Romans crucified Christ. I've even heard people say, we've crucified Christ because He was wounded for our transgression. He was bruised for our iniquities. And someone else said he was smitten of God and afflicted. Well, that's how people saw him. But in Christ's own words, I'd rather judge the matter. Who's responsible for Jesus Christ's death? The Gospel of John, chapter 10, verse 17. Therefore doth my Father love me, because I lay down my life, that I might take it again. No man taketh it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. This commandment have I received of my Father. Jesus Christ had the power to take his life, or to lay his life down, or to take it back. And he did both. That's why he prayed not to enter into temptation, because it was in his power to lay his life down or to not lay his life down. He submitted to death by his own choice, by his own volition, voluntarily. No one forced him to die. Nobody killed Christ except that Christ gave himself over to be killed. You know, it is impossible but that offenses should come, but woe to them by whom they come. The Son of Man is delivered as it is written of him, but woe to them by whom he is crucified. You know, woe to him who betrays him. Woe to him that hammers the nails. Woe to them that accuse him in the assembly. But as far as like some sort of blood guilt over the Jews or anything like that, that is so, you know, or the Kenites, for those of you who don't believe the Jews are the Jews, but you believe the Jews are the sons of the devil, and that the Jews are actually the sons of Cain, who is, by extension, the son of the devil. The Apostle John taught clearly who the children of the devil are. Whosoever commits sin and doeth not righteousness is not of God. Because he that is born of God does not commit sin. You know, in this, the children of God are manifest in the children of the devil. In sin, we find the manifestation of the devil's children. And that's very simply laid out in 1 John chapter 3. Children of the devil are not physical seed. It's a spiritual seed. Just like the children of God are a spiritual seed. And if you don't get that, you are so far from Christ, you have no idea who Christ even is. The Jews aren't to blame as a nation. Blindness has happened to them. All those things, you know, the blindness and wisdom hidden and all that. Now, men are responsible for what they do, even if they are blind, because they say, we see. And whatever we are, even if we were made to be it, we're going to answer for it, because that is what we are. But Christ laid down his life. Verse 27, and there followed him a great company of people and of women, which also bewailed and lamented him. But Jesus, turning unto them, said, Daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming in the which they shall say, Blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bear, and the paps which never gave suck. Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, Fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in a green tree, what shall be done in the dry? These women are following and weeping. You know, there were other people present. Their voices did not prevail. You know, Peter denied Christ and ran off, and the other disciples were scattered and nowhere to be found, but there were many women who followed after, very brave. But women have a certain protection. They can be there because they're less suspicious, because in the society that they're in, they have no real role. You know, there weren't women leading uprisings, and women, there was this sort of a freedom of femininity which allowed you to be able to approach, to go to a criminal. Now, if a man goes and talks to Barabbas, let's say, it's immediately suspicious. Why are they talking? But if a woman comes, it's his mother, it's his sister, it's a lover. And with Jesus also, the women could follow closely, that he could speak to them. He said, Daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me. But we fear ourselves. He knows he's going to rise from the dead. And this, the hardest parts, are they over yet or not? I don't know. The mocking, what's worse, the pain, the mocking, they're going to mock him from the cross. mean, that might be the most tempting moment of all, to come down off the cross. That's what they say to him. If you are the Christ, come down. How tempting that might be. It says, weep for yourselves and for your children. He's going to live forever. Well, what about us? What about our children? What's going to happen to them? Don't waste your tears on me. Weep rather for yourselves and for your children. The days are coming in which they will say, blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bear and the paps which never gave suck. I'll tell you why. Because when you hold your dead child in your hand, you wish you were never a mother. When you see all that work, you know, children represent such promise and such hope. You want to see them grow up. But when you see them all slain, their bodies burning, perhaps he's referring to the destruction of Jerusalem. Perhaps he's referring yet to the end of the age. And I say probably both. The wombs that never bear, the paps that never gave suck. There are times, you know, woe to them that are with child, to them that give suck in those days. Because when bad times come, when there's blood and fire and pillars of smoke and the famines and pestilences, and children are susceptible. You know, every year, I forget exactly how many, hundreds of millions starve, or many people every year starve to death, most of them children. And that's the way it goes. With tough times, the children are the one who suffer the most, and the mothers, maybe even more. And they're going to say, blessed are the barren. Blessed are those who never knew motherhood, that they should endure the loss that they would be feeling at that time. Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. It's in the book of Revelation, it says, the kings of the earth and the great men and the chief men and the chief captains and the mighty men and every bondman and every free man hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains and said, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath is come. The days are coming when that's going to begin to come to pass. They're going to say, let us be buried under this rubble so that we can be hidden from his face. They don't want to face their judgment. You can't hide. The judgment is coming. What if they do these things in the green tree, what shall they be done in the dry? This is a bit of a parable, isn't it? The green tree, the living wood, must refer to the Lord. Because that's what's being, if they do these things in the green tree. So we have, the green tree is the Lord. What shall be done in the dry? There's a double variable there. What they might do, and what it's being done in. I've heard it suggested, the dry refers to the nation. When he's gone, when he's taken out of the world, what happens to the nation of Israel? Once he's gone, what will be done? If they crucify me, what are they going to do to the nation once I'm gone? So that cursed fig tree that withered away. Remember, he cursed the fig tree? This is in another gospel. But he cursed the fig tree as he was going to the temple or coming from the temple. I forgot which way he was headed. No man eat fruit on you forever hereafter. And their house was left to them desolate. And they would do, if they did that to Christ, how much worse would it be in the days that followed? And you can bet in the sieges, you know, Masada, the Jews committed suicide rather than submit to the Romans. But still, fall on us and hide us from the face, cover us, that we have not to see him and face our judgment. I don't know, that seems to be connected to this somehow. I heard someone suggest, the dry is the Holy Spirit. That doesn't make sense to me. For if they do these things in a green tree, it's connected to the previous verse, fall on us, and to the hills cover us. For if they do these things in a green tree, what shall be done in a dry? A green tree could refer to the character of his ministry. He was healing, and teaching, and kind. a green tree, refreshing. He brought forth the refreshing of the Lord. You know, Christ was like a breath of fresh air, bringing forth healing and good doctrine. And he was such a kind and humble person when he came. But at the second advent, the character of the ministry is completely different. And the ministers have another character as well. You know, when they start smiting the earth with all plagues as often as they will, and bringing fire forth out of their mouths to devour their enemies, if you think they hated Christ, how much more are they going to hate his ministers in the end times? If they do that to Christ, what are they going to do when the tree is not so green? You know, a green tree comes, Christ's ministry, and this is what they do to it. What will they do when a dry tree comes that gives them nothing good, only bad, that brings forth nothing that man should desire? Christ offered them many good things, but the ministries of the end times are not going to be offering good things. We are going to offer them plagues. We're going to offer them famine. We're going to offer them drought. We're going to offer them fire. And what will be done to those ministers? Well, we already know in the Revelation, they're going to overcome them and kill them. And they're not going to suffer their bodies to be buried as Christ was, but they're going to leave their corpses in the streets. And what will happen to their children? But very soon, when they rise and they stand on their feet, that's when people are going to really begin to fear. Fear fell upon them that saw them. Great fear. When their enemies behold them. Verse 32. And there were also two other malefactors led with him to be put to death. When they were come to the place which is called Calvary, there they crucified him. The Calvary is the Greek for the Hebrew Golgotha, a skull. And the malefactors, one on the right hand and the other on the left. Then said Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they parted his raiment and cast lots. And the people stood beholding. And the rulers also with them, deriding him, saying, He saved others, let him save himself, if he be the Christ, the chosen of God. And the soldiers also mocked him, coming to him and offering him vinegar, and saying, If thou be the king of the Jews, save thyself. And a superscription also was written over him in letters of Greek and Latin and Hebrew. This is the King of the Jews. And here we have the account of the malefactors brought and crucified with him. And the other Gospels there describe two thieves, and they both mock him. And they were brought later, after he was crucified, after he began to be crucified. So they would often crucify as many people at the same time. First they brought Christ and these malefactors. They were crucified with him. Later they brought two thieves who mocked him. And that they both mocked him. The same cut him with their teeth, it says. The reason is because people will look at this and they're like, oh, there's a contradiction. It's like, not really. All it is different details are given in different accounts. And all these verses, 34 through 38, you know, they parted his garment, they cast lots, the people stood, they look, they stare at me. The rulers deride him, he saved others. You know, in this gospel, they do not quote, Eli, Eli, lama azaftani, from Psalm 22, but the details here are right from Psalm 22. Psalm 22 is another one of those prophecies of Christ, 1,000 years before he was born, written by David. And this, the fact that it was written is indisputable because of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, the exact timing of the writing, I suppose some might dispute. But the fact that it was in existence prior to Jesus is absolute. Because it's proven, you know, with archaeological evidence via the Dead Sea Scrolls. And also that the words lion, when it says a lion on my hands and feet, is wrong. The original rendering was, they pierced my hands and my feet. Referring to the crucifixion of Christ from 1,000 years before he was born. Psalm 22 verse 1 says, My God, why hast thou forsaken me? God did not forsake Christ. In fact, later in the psalm, if you read verse 24, it says, "He hath not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, neither hath he hid his face from him. But when he cried unto him, he heard." People say that God hid his face from Christ when Christ was on the cross because Christ became sin and God can't look on sin. But Christ is God. I mean, it's just a bunch of nonsense. It's a bunch of theological gobbledygook passed from hand to hand by tradition. It's just a traditional interpretation. And people's minds are conditioned to think in these terms. God did not forsake Christ. But Christ felt forsaken. Just like you might feel forsaken, but I say God has not forsaken you. That's the thing, is like, on the one hand, they want to say, God forsake Christ. Well, then God might forsake me, won't he? But no, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. He did not forsake Christ. But Christ felt forsaken. You might come to a place where you feel forsaken and lost and totally out of your way. But God does not forsake his chosen. But you might feel and you might say, why have you forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me and from the words of my roaring? You know, David wrote this 1,000 years before Jesus. O my God, I cry in the daytime, but thou hearest not, and in the night season, and am not silent, but thou art holy. You know, think about it. He cried in the garden. He cried from the cross. Thou inhabited the praises of Israel. Our fathers trusted in thee. They trusted and you delivered them. They cried unto thee and were delivered. They trusted in thee and were not confounded. But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised of the people. All they that see me laugh me to scorn. Now listen carefully. You really see how Christ is contained in this. This is a prophecy of exactly what happened to him. And there's no doubt that it did happen to him. We have the physical evidence in the shroud they call from Turin. The linen cloth that wrapped his body bears his body image. I don't know how it got there. It really doesn't matter. They may not be able to scientifically prove anything by it, whether he raised from the dead or not, but it certainly is suggestive. All they that see me laugh me to scorn, verse 7. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head, saying, he trusted in the Lord that he would deliver him. Let him deliver him, seeing he delighted in him. If thou be the Christ, come down off the cross. But thou art he that took me out of the womb. Thou didst make me hope when I was upon my mother's breasts. I was cast upon thee from the womb. Thou art my God from my mother's belly. Be not far from me, for trouble is near. For there is none to help. Many bulls have compassed me. Strong bulls of Bashan have beset me round about. They gaped upon me with their mouths as a ravening, roaring lion. The chief priests, the elders, the lions of the people, the leaders, the great men, the strong men, all gathered against him. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. Do you understand the way crucifixion, what it does to the body, as the gravity pulls and pulls, and the bones are pulled and pulled. My heart is like wax. It is melted in the midst of my bowels. All the feelings that must be felt as you hang there. Everything within you melting, and the thirst and the feeling. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaveth to my jaws. And thou hast brought me to the dust of death. For dogs have compassed me. The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. Dogs have compassed me. You know, Jesus called the heathen dogs. It is not fit to give the children's meat to dogs. The Romans have all surrounded him to crucify him as well. Verse 17, that I may tell all my bones. Not a bone of him was broken. They look, they stare at me. They part my garments among them and cast lots on my clothes. They parted his vesture among them. They cast lots for them. They gambled for his clothing. 1,000 years before he was crucified, this was known. I mean, it's easy to say, well, you know, they read this and then they wrote their gospel so they would match this. But they manufactured the Shroud of Turin that it would match this. That's what I want to know. Because we can't replicate it with all our technology. Not yet, at least, right? How did these first century illiterate fishermen do something like that? It certainly is suggestive, isn't it? And then the scientists who have studied it, like Alan Wanger, they've looked at it with the polarized lenses and explored it and found dice. The dice used to gamble for his clothing. Because the wealthy Joseph of Arimathea apparently not only buried Jesus in this linen cloth, but actually took everything connected with his crucifixion and buried it with him. And that would be according to Jewish custom, because anything that had the blood on it would be buried with the man, because it was part of him. The nails are there. The whip, he got the whip. I mean, he got the whip. And they had put an amulet on him, a Roman amulet, to sort of signify as a mock of the chief priest's breastplate. Who knows? Bizarre things. But they're all present there. Very few people know of all this. But it's there. It speaks from history. Be not far from me, O Lord, O my strength, hasty to help me. Deliver my soul from the sword, my only one, my darling, from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, from the horns of the bulls, for thou hast heard me. I changed the order there because the sequence is a little out of order in the English. Thou hast heard me from the horns of the unicorns. It's the deliver me from the lion's mouth, from the horns of the bulls. And then the clause, for thou hast heard me, belongs with verse 22. And I'm not going to read the rest of the psalm. But you can see in the psalm also the shadows of the resurrection. The hints at what would come. But read again, Luke, the correlation of all those things. The way they mocked him, the way, the things they said, the things they did. It was all told before, and it was all fulfilled. Verse 39, and one of the malefactors which were hanged railed on him, saying, if thou be Christ, save thyself and us. But the other answering rebuked him, saying, dost thou not fear God, seeing thou art in the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man hath done nothing amiss. And he said unto Jesus, Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. And Jesus said unto him, verily I say to thee today, thou shalt be with me in paradise. The reason I read it that way, notice I said, verily I say to thee today, because there's no punctuation in Greek. And this passage represents basically a tradition that has crept into the text that has caused it to be punctuated improperly to give the wrong impression about death. For one, we have other scriptures that rule this out categorically. Jesus' soul was not left in hell. Jesus, the man, went into his grave. Now, when he gave up the ghost, as he's about to, his spirit returns to God. But the spirit of the man is not the man. The man himself, when Christ was raised, he said, touch me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father. He hadn't gone up yet. Jesus that day was not going to paradise. He was going into the grave. He was going to be in the grave for 3 days and three nights, as it is written. He wasn't going to be in paradise for 3 days and three nights. He was going into the grave for 3 days and three nights. You can't take a single passage like this, or the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, and overthrow all the teaching of the scripture as far as what happens to the dead. When you die, you don't go to paradise. You go into the grave. And you wait for the resurrection. And you may not perceive the passage of time because there's no thoughts in the grave. Your thoughts all perish. So it may seem like when you die, the next thing you know, it's paradise. And you don't sit there like waiting in darkness or something with a consciousness. Your thoughts perish. You have no thoughts, no feelings, no anger, no hatred, no nothing. It's according to the book of Ecclesiastes. It's funny, the people will quote Ecclesiastes chapter 12 where it says the spirit returns to God who gave it, but they'll ignore the other places in Ecclesiastes where it makes it clear that the dead don't know anything. The dead know not anything. The dead men. David is not ascended into the heavens. Why would this guy go to paradise and David not? And we know he's going to be in paradise. He's going to be in the kingdom of God. Paradise, you know, is Revelation chapter 2, it says, him that overcometh Well, I give to eat of the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. Then you really even, you read in chapter 22 of the new heavens and the new earth. You know, and he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. And in the midst of the street of it, and on the other side of the river, there was the tree of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits and yielded her fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it. And his servants shall serve him, and they shall see his face, and his name shall be in their foreheads. And there shall be no night there, they shall need no candle, neither light of the sun, for the Lord God giveth them light. And they shall reign forever and ever. The paradise of God is not where you go when you're dead. When you're dead, you go into the grave. This is punctuated improperly, saying, verily I say to you today that you will be with me in paradise. That is what Jesus said to the thief in the house. He didn't say, today you're going to be with me in paradise. Today you will be with me in paradise. No, that's wrong. You know, I think of Deuteronomy chapter 4. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today. You shall soon utterly perish from off the land. It's a Hebraism. It's a Hebrew figure of speech. Read Deuteronomy chapter 4. It's used there. It's not saying today you're going to perish off the face of the land. What it's saying is, I'm telling you now today to emphasize the solemnity of the occasion. Today, I say to you, you will be with me in paradise. And of course he means in the resurrection. And that's the way this guy would understand it. Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. Really, that's all I have to say about that. Because there are so many other scriptures. You know, read 1 Corinthians 15, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. The dead are asleep, quote unquote. They're waiting. They're not in paradise. The dead, you know, Jesus himself said it in John 5, the day's coming when all that are in their graves shall hear his voice and come forth, some to the resurrection of life, some to the resurrection of damnation. There's no, and also 1 John, the Gospel of John chapter 3. We're going to do John next, but hey, why not mention it now? Because we're surely going to mention it then, and it never is repeated often enough. He says, in verse 13, and no man hath ascended up to heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man, which is in heaven. It's a very simple truth, spoken in doctrine. That's another thing. You can't take an offhand comment, you can't take an off-the-cuff remark in the midst of a narrative and overthrow the doctrine spoken in doctrine. No man hath ascended up to heaven, but he that came down from heaven. That means no one has ascended into heaven except the one who came down, which is the Son of Man, which is in heaven now. No one else has ascended. The resurrection is not come yet. Anyone who says the dead are already raised is a heretic and not a Christian. They are corruptors of the doctrine of Jesus Christ. Because that's what he taught. No man hath ascended up into heaven. That's it. Only Jesus. So that thief would not be in paradise with Christ that day. That day, they were going to both go into the grave. And after 3 days, Jesus was going to rise. And at the end of the world, he's going to raise that malefactor from the dead, and he will be with him in paradise. That's all. Verse 44, and it was about the sixth hour. And there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour. About 3 p.m. And the sun was darkened, and the veil of the temple was rent in the midst. And when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, maybe that's when he said, Eli, Eli, lama azaftani. He said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And having said thus, he gave up the ghost. The spirit returned to God who gave it. That's death. When your spirit and soul are separated, you die. Your spirit is not your conscious being. John the Baptist came in the spirit and power of Elijah. So it doesn't, you know, when God's spirit enters us, it doesn't make us God. It doesn't make us him personally. It means his spirit has entered into us. Now, the Holy Spirit is different from other spirits, per se, as being, he is a person. God is a spirit. But the spirit of a man is not the person of the man. And when you die, when you give up the ghost, it doesn't mean that you are personally going back to God. It means your spirit goes to God, but you are dead. Dust thou art, and to dust thou shalt return. What do you think? He's just speaking to the body. Actually, you don't return to dust. You go to heaven. Your body goes to dust, but you go to heaven. Uh-uh. Dust thou art, and to dust thou shalt return. That's what you are. You are dust. You are not spirit. You are not God. You are dust. And you will be dust unless God raises you up. It's the arrogance of man. They always think, oh, we're going to float away. You're nothing. You're going to be a rotten corpse in the grave. Bones, rotten flesh, filth, abomination. And unless he raises you up, you're nothing. I always think it's funny when they say, well, you know, we have ancient accounts of darkness. You know, they recorded every meteorological event. Why there's no mention of this darkness? The earth, it can refer to the land. It means locally it was dark. It could have been just low clouds during that time. It needn't be like something that would be like, wow, it's dark. But I mean, it's just the cloud covers. And also, you got to understand, there also would be an interest early on in suppressing information about anything supernatural with Christ. As the movement began to burgeon after his resurrection, there was definitely a sense that it had to be kept under wraps. The veil in the temple was rent in the midst. The veil was this curtain that separated the holy place from the most holy place. That separated God from everyone else. And the high priest only was allowed to enter into the holiest of all once a year, and not without blood. But when Christ was crucified, that place was ripped open, signifying that he had made the way to the holiest place clear now through the veil of his flesh. Through his sacrifice, we then, by him, have access directly to God. And we don't need to go through priests anymore. But whoever he shall choose, we can go and we can approach to God, boldly come to the throne. That doesn't mean you go, hey, JC. What it means is not rudely come. It means the way man ought to come before God is inching forward as a worm on his face. But that we could just come and speak to him at all is quite bold. Verse 47. Now when the centurion saw what was done, he glorified God, saying, certainly, this was a righteous man. And all the people that came together to that sight, beholding the things which were done, smote their breasts and returned. And all his acquaintance and the women that followed him from Galilee stood afar off, beholding these things. So this whole thing is quite a spectacle. It's drawn quite a crowd. And they're standing afar off, watching, seeing what happens. The centurion in another place declares, surely this was the Son of God. So I suppose this is supplemental. Maybe first he says this and later he says that. And why would he say that? And I think it's because the way he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And he died. You understand, crucifixion, people die slowly and agonizingly, sometimes hanging there for days. And in Mark, they're quite astonished how quickly he dies, because he laid his life down. He'd accomplished all the suffering he needed to accomplish. People always have to make out that Christ suffered more than anyone else ever, and that was the worst thing that had ever happened to anyone. I'll tell you what, though, the temptation was never greater, considering it was voluntary. What man would volunteer for that, to go through that? To suffer through the temptation of being, say, come down from the cross, and you can. When he had accomplished everything, he gave up the ghost. He died voluntarily. And he saw that, the centurion, he said, wow, surely that was a righteous man. Did you see what he just did? Father, to your hands I commend my spirit, and then he dies? Surely this was a righteous man. Surely this is the Son of God. Depending on who heard him when. You know, banging their fists against their chests. And all his acquaintance. You know, people saw, and they a lot of people probably early on when this is all being determined, you know, not really realizing what's going on, and then by the time, you know, he's being crucified, it's already well into the day, you know, 6 hours about noon, but he's already up on the cross by noon. You know, the first 6 hours, the trial early in the morning, you know, scourging, all this going on, and people just becoming aware of it, but it's already too late. But the main thing is Christ let it happen. He laid his life down, a ransom for many. He offered himself. Verse 50, and behold, there was a man named Joseph, a counselor, and he was a good man and a just. The same had not consented to the counsel and deed of them. He was of Arimathea, a city of the Jews, who also waited for the kingdom of God. This man went to Pilate and begged the body of Jesus. And he took it down and wrapped it in linen. We have that linen still. And laid it in a sepulcher that was hewn in stone, wherein never man before was laid. And they find bits of that kind of limestone or whatever kind of, I forget, granite, whatever. That rock, samples of it have been found on the linen. Trace samples of it. And he laid it in a sepulcher that was hewn in stone, where never man before was laid. And that day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on, and the women also which came with him from Galilee followed after, and beheld the sepulchre, and how his body was laid. And they returned and prepared spices and ointments, and rested the Sabbath day according to the commandment. So he's buried. They buried him quickly, because it was a day of preparation. The feast is on the next day. It's a Sabbath day. And therefore, they have to get him in the grave. And as I said, we know now from the evidence of the physical evidence that Joseph not only obtained the body of Jesus, but he obtained everything that had, just about everything that had his blood on, except probably the ground that was there, and buried everything that had his blood on it with him. The crown of thorns is on the shroud. And there were all kinds of flowers laid around his body as well. And, different objects, hammer, the hammer that they hammered the nails in. I mean, this man was rich. You know, if he goes to a soldier, I'll give you, $50 for that hammer. Sure, it only cost me 10. You know, those dice. I want those dice. I want this. I want, everything he wanted to buy. I'm just saying that because it's on the cloth. And the funny thing is the objects as they are seen on the cloth are accurate to ones that have been found archaeologically. The hammers are like the hammers they use. The nails are just like the ones they would have used. So it's amazing. Look at the website shroud.com. There's a section on that website called Scientific Papers. There's got to be over 100 papers there. I've read them all. Why don't you go read them all? If you know so much about everything, go read. And then look at it. See what the real men of science who have looked at that have found. And these are, there are so many papers. It's like there are always skeptical organizations that just put out one side of the story. Never mind that there are many legitimate and respected agnostic scientists who've done work on it, determining, yes, there's blood, and, they won't say the things you can't say scientifically. But they're also not going to say something ridiculous like it's a painting or some other nonsense like that. It's not a painting. It is a legitimate first century cloth, and it is, I'll tell you what, it may not be scientifically provable, but it's the body of Jesus Christ. Like I said, you look at it, the evidence is not scientifically conclusive, but as a man, I find it compelling. As a man, it is suggestive.